from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
Hey Jude, don't make it bad. Take a sad song and make it better.
Once upon a time, two British rock and roll bands dominated the music scene, the Boy Next Door Beatles and the Born to Be Wild Rolling Stones. Journalist Tom Wolfe wrote, "The Beatles want to hold your hand, but the Stones want to burn down your town." And in his new book, Beatles vs. Stones, John McMillan explores the myths behind their rivalry and offers revealing behind-the-scenes stories about the two groups. That's next, after this.
Maybe then I'll fade away and not have to face the facts.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
Yesterday, all my troubles seemed so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday.
Yesterday by the Beatles, and the Beatles, as well as the Rolling Stones, are by most lights the two greatest rock and roll bands of our time, of our yesterdays. Though clearly, both friends and rivals, they were foils for one another, and that the Beatles, though born and raised in a rough proletarian part of Liverpool, were the wholesome chaps, the Apollonian group that performed for the Royals, while the Stones, who grew up in more comfortable and bourgeois London, were the bad boys, the self-styled fighting Dionysian men. In his book, Beatles vs. Stones, John McMillan, assistant professor of history at Georgia State, gives a well-researched and definitive account of the band's amity and their battles with and against each other. The author of Smoking Typewriters, The 60s Underground Press, and The Rise of Alternative Media in America, John McMillan joins us for this forum hour as we ask you, our listeners, to weigh in. Not only on music, but on aesthetics and just about everything else, Beatles or Stones. John McMillan, good to have you with us. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, pleased to have you. And I guess this is a rivalry that continues to be in many ways, well, not only extant, but, well, misunderstood. I want to get right at it here, just what I intimated in the beginning of my introduction in terms of more of the nuances of it. A lot of the myths and publicity stunts and press inventions of the Beatles and the Rolling Stones are really responsible, attributable to the images that both of them had and the images that were created for both of them.
Well, I think that's right. I think you put it well in your introduction. You know, members of both groups were always friendly towards each other for the most part, and they enjoyed each other's company, and they liked socializing, and they admired what the other group was doing. But at the same time, they also saw themselves in competition. And so they never stopped trying to outperform one another, whether it was for, you know, record sales or aesthetic credibility or cultural influence or whatever else. So they had a kind of competitive friendship throughout the 60s.
But things began to change also, I suspect, at least from reading your book, and there were more tensions. I mean, Lennon was saying they're trying to imitate us and calling it was kind of surprising and shocking a bit to read that he was using the F word, the homophobic F word about Mick Jagger's dancing.
That's right. Well, that was a famously cranky interview that John Lennon gave to Jan Wenner, who was the publisher of Rolling Stone magazine. And John was in kind of a difficult place at the time when he said those things. But you're right. He suggested that the Stones had been imitating the Beatles, and he was perturbed by that. And he was particularly pointed in his criticisms of Mick Jagger.
What's particularly illuminating, though, about these two groups and just, again, the images that they realized in their work and to the public in general that you draw out is just how much a lot of this was manipulated behind the scenes. I mean, in a very class-ridden society, which England certainly was at the time, as I said, you had kind of an inversion, the Stones being sort of the bourgeois types presented as bad boys and maybe more proletarian, and the Beatles being presented as the good boys, the bourgeois types.
Right. I mean, that's slightly complicated by the fact that there were some class differences within the two groups. But on balance, you're absolutely correct. The Beatles were from Liverpool, and they were mostly working class kids who were facing a career of, you know, low prestige occupations if they had not become world famous as musicians. And by contrast, the Stones were from London, and certainly Mick Jagger and Brian Jones, two of the leading lights of that band, were middle or upper middle class. Mick Jagger went to the London School of Economics, which is a very prestigious school, and this is at a time when only about 2% of British kids went on to college. And Brian Jones did not go on to university study, but he could have if he'd wanted to. And then also the fact that the Stones were from London mattered a bit because, you know, especially back then, people from London really looked down at northern England, and they thought that Liverpool was kind of a culturally barren wasteland without a lot going on. And they had, I think, a bit of a snobbish attitude towards the area from which the Beatles emerged.
But so much of this emergence of both the Beatles and the Stones had to do with their agents. I mean, Brian Epstein and Andrew Oldham behind the scenes. Didn't Andrew Oldham, in fact, go to the Village Voice and say, would you let your daughter marry these guys, meaning the members of the Rolling Stones?
Yeah. It wasn't the Village Voice. It was a tabloid in England. But sure, he was trying to play up the idea that the Rolling Stones were the bad guys and the Rolling Stones would not be popular with adults, that they were the type of group that, you know, disaffected teens might glom onto. And that was in contrast to, of course, the Beatles, because especially in England, the Beatles were very popular at all levels of society. They got favorable coverage in newspapers and adults seemed to like them. They played for the British royal family. They were touted by politicians. And so the Stones decided that, you know, by contrast, they would be the group that parents and adults despised. And so a lot of that was, in fact, marketing.
But there was a time when both Mick Jagger and Paul McCartney were talking about a merger of their businesses, and that was killed off by Alan Klein. Mick Jagger actually encouraged the Beatles to sign with Alan Klein, didn't he?
Well, this is a controversial story, but I believe that's the case. The Rolling Stones switched managers, and they attached themselves to Alan Klein, who was known as a wizard when it came to music industry accounting practices and whatnot. But he gradually revealed himself to be kind of a thief and a crook, and he took advantage of a lot of the artists that he worked with.
He also stole Brian Jones's girlfriend. Yeah,
Alan Klein.
Yeah. Didn't he also steal Jones' girlfriend?
You might be thinking of Keith Richards. Keith Richards did that.
Oh, okay.
But Alan Klein had a poor reputation, and then the Beatles signed with Alan Klein after the Stones had done it. And there's always been some suggestion that maybe Mick Jagger wanted to get Alan Klein off his back, and so he recommended him to the Beatles.
Let's talk a little bit about Brian Jones, though. I mean, he doesn't come off very well in your book.
Well, he was a tough guy to like. He had some really people who knew him said that he had some very good qualities, and he would listen to your conversation, and he could be kind and polite. And the fact that he was, you know, raised in a kind of upper middle class environment meant that he had some genteel qualities, but he was a bit of a sociopath too, a very self interested guy who would be manipulative and tough to work with in a band. The funny thing about Brian Jones is that he always thought that he should be the star of the Rolling Stones, that he was the only guy who thought that maybe he would be a better front man than Mick Jagger for that group.
How about the relationship between Lennon and McCartney? You know, when you read your book, you learn things about Lennon that are not necessarily very positive. And I'm talking about not only what I mentioned before, alluded to before, I mean, homophobia. She was perfectly capable of hauling at his manager, Brian Epstein, but also anti-Semitism. And yet he and McCartney seem to have a good working relationship, seem to get along. And yet, you know, in many people's minds, in my mind and memory, when John Lennon was assassinated, Paul McCartney said, well, it's a drag, isn't it? I mean, those were his exact words, and kind of a shock to many people. And now he's, through the years, said, well, I was just shocked. That was why I said that.
That's right. Well, you know, in John Lennon's defense, he could be a terribly difficult person as well, and he would say homophobic and anti-Semitic remarks directed at people that he knew well, and he tried to hurt people. That was sort of one of the things he did, is he would find people's emotional or vulnerabilities or insecurities and hurt them, but he did grow. He was capable of growing and maturing, and towards the end of his life, I'm sure he was mortified by some of his earlier behavior. And then with regard to you know, Paul and John, they also had kind of a very loving relationship for a long time. But, you know, only really good friends can, you know, butt heads the way they did, you know, towards the end of their life. And when Paul McCartney very famously said, he was asked about how he felt about John Lennon being assassinated, and Paul said it's a drag, I think that was somewhat misinterpreted. You can go on YouTube, in fact, and watch Paul say that. And I don't think he meant it in a flippant way. I think he meant it like, it's a really big drag, and he was a little bit at a loss for words. So I wouldn't make too much of that incident.
We're talking, if you just joined us, with John McMillan, assistant professor of history at Georgia State. He studies 20th century social movements, and he's the author of Smoking Typewriters, The 60s Underground Press, and The Rise of Alternative Media in America, and most recently, Beatles versus Stones. And you may want to weigh in here in terms of your own preferences between the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, because certainly those kind of debates continue. And so do the question of their politics. And I want to take that up with you, John McMillan, because Revolution came out in 1968, and it was kind of a put-down of the New Left. Before that, we had all that flower power, and we had the Stones talking about street-fighting men and all of those what appeared to be rebellious and even revolutionary-styled anthems. But both groups really weren't terribly political, were they?
Yeah, that's the
irony. It's kind of the bottom line. You know, yeah.
Well, you know, this is what got me into the book. You know, many years ago, as you mentioned, I wrote a book on underground newspapers in the 60s. And right around the summer of 1968, there was a big ideological debate, at least in the minds of a lot of youth culture aficionados, over which band, the Beatles or the Stones, had the correct political analysis. And the Beatles were thought to align themselves with flower power and the hippies and the kind of gentle aesthetic radicalism of the era. And you see that expressed in John's song Revolution, which you mentioned. And the Stones had that song Street Fighting Man, which seemed to suggest some affiliation with the kind of, you know, the new left politics, the politics of confrontation that was emerging
militancy
among young radical youth. That's right. That's right. And so there was, you know, a bit of a divide along those lines in the minds of a lot of music fans who took this stuff incredibly seriously, even though, as you were suggesting, I don't think either group ever really articulated a very coherent political, you know, worldview.
Just for the sake of contrast, let's hear a bit of Revolution and Street Fighting Man.
You say you want a revolution, well, you know. Tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world.
Hey, a little sampling of Revolution by the Beatles and Street Fighting Man by the Stones. Actually, the Stones really pushed the envelope, John McMillan, particularly when they had a song like Sympathy for the Devil. I mean, it almost sounded like they were trying to foment evil at that time.
Well, sure. I mean, the narrator in that song is, in fact, the devil, which is certainly pushing the envelope, as you suggest. You know, Robert Kennedy actually was murdered at the very time that the Stones were recording that song, so they had to change the lyric. It went from, you know, who killed Kennedy to who killed the Kennedys, because that that terrible event happened right while they were recording that song in, I think, June of 1968.
There was also not only rivalry, but perhaps what could be characterized as some resentment in the fact that the Beatles came to America to all that screaming of young people and the like, and they sort of essentially established themselves, the Ed Sullivan Show, etc., here in the United States. And for the Stones, it was just easy to kind of glide in on the Beatles' glory here and on their acceptance here.
Well, you know, when the Beatles came, though, of course, you know, Beatlemania had hit and they had this just incredible reception that everyone is very well aware of. And after the Beatles came, the Dave Clark Five, and I think also Herman Hermits and some other British bands came, and they also were very well received. And but when the Stones arrived, they had a much tougher time. They got some they had some big turnouts at some of their shows in New York and San Francisco. But when the Stones went to Middle America, especially, they were regarded as kind of a freakish circus act. People didn't really know what to make of them. And they encountered a great deal of hostility because of the way they looked and the way they behaved. And so they did not quite have they didn't have anything nearly, they didn't have quite the rapturous reception that the Beatles got. There's a big contrast.
But the idea that the Stones copied the Beatles or imitated the Beatles, I mean, which, as we alluded to before, John Lennon seemed to feel. I mean, after Sgt. Pepper was released, their Satanic Majesty's report came out, that is the Stones, and after Rubber Soul, Aftermath came out. And those were particularly, I suppose, in Lennon's mind about imitation, weren't they?
Yes. You know, at the time, it has to be said that a lot of bands were following the Beatles' creative lead. But the Stones did it in some conspicuous ways. And so, you know, Rubber Soul, which came out in 1965, was a big record for the Beatles because they were moving away from their cuddly mop-top image and writing more mature and autobiographical songs, and they were experimenting with some unusual instruments. And it seemed like a big sonic leap from what they were doing previously. And then very shortly afterwards, the Stones came out with Aftermath, and I think the Stones tried to critically reposition themselves in a very similar way. The Beatles used a sitar on Rubber Soul, and so the Stones used a sitar on Aftermath. And the Stones seem to be, you know, trying to progress in ways similar to the Beatles.
Let's hear a little bit from Rubber Soul. In fact, let's hear a cut of Norwegian Wood by the Beatles. We'll come back to that in a moment. Actually, they started, John McMillan, to stagger their record releases, not to hurt each other's sales too, right?
Right. They would get together and not want to compete for record sales directly. So then, and they were both putting out so much material, you know, 45s as well as records at a pretty rapid clip. But they would sometimes try to make sure that their record releases didn't conflict, although they were not always successful at that.
She once had me. She showed me her room. Isn't it good? Norwegian wood. She asked me to stay and stay.
Well, all that peace, love, and flower power, the Beatles versus the militancy and the street fighting men ethos of the Rolling Stones. We're talking about that divide, which certainly had an extraordinary influence in its time and ongoing influence. John McMillan has written a book about the rivalry, the friendship, when they were at cross purposes, these two bands, and when they were more, well, willing to work together and so forth. In some ways, I get the sense from your book, John McMillan, that there was maybe more of a kind of Altamont than Woodstock in that era, in the air, so to speak.
Well, in what sense? I'm not sure.
Well, you know, when you talk about the divide, you know, on the one hand, everybody's thinking Beatles, flower power, peace and love. Mm-hmm. But certainly Altamont has been one of those things that has been more associated with the Stones. And in a sense, it's particularly when things started to go awry about flower power, Haight-Ashbury here in San Francisco and the like, it moved more toward Altamont being, again, in the air, as I said.
Sure. I mean, one interesting thing to point out is that John Lennon's reputation nowadays is so much the idea that he was a peacenik and that he was, you know, anti-war and so on. But he was never on that particular issue. He wavered quite a bit. He sometimes gave suggestions or statements that thinking that would lead people to think that he believed in political violence as a strategic possibility. He was never completely committed to nonviolence and pacifism the way a lot of people think. But certainly around the time of Altamont, where of course, Meredith Hunter was murdered at the front of the stage and the Hells Angels were there with pool cues, beating people up and everything. For a lot of people, that event really seemed to signify the death knell of the utopian dream of the 1960s. That was a very violent and unpleasant spectacle. And it seemed to monkey wrench the utopian fantasies a lot of people had of what the 60s would be about.
Well, you know, when you compare these two bands, and the comparisons will go on till perhaps kingdom come, but the Beatles disbanded in the 1970s and John Lennon died in 1980. And in a sense, you have to think of the likelihood that, like when we talked about John F. Kennedy on the 50th anniversary of his assassination, the fact that he was always remembered as being young was to his advantage, I think. And in that sense, maybe even though, let's hear a cut from the Stones, even though they sing about time being on their side, maybe it's more on the Beatles. Let's hear. Rolling Stones, time is on my side. Well, I'll put the question out to you, our listeners now. Which group has time on their side? Or which group do you prefer? Which group do you like more? Which group influenced you more? Or which group continues to resonate for you? All of those questions, I think, are important, but really the most important is why, the sub-question of that. Let me give you a toll-free number to call. It's 866-733-6786, and you can join us now, and we do welcome your calls. Again, toll-free, 866-733-6786, and you can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on this segment. Or, of course, you can communicate with us with any questions or comments or stating your preference, Beatles or Rolling Stones, by tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQED Forum, and you can also go to our Facebook page. And Michael writes, I heard that in the record sales during the 60s, the Beatles topped the charts, but second was not the Stones, but Herman's Hermits. Is this not true? My source is Tom Petty and his show Buried Treasure on XM Radio. You alluded before, John McMillan, to Herman's Hermits coming to the U.S. before the Stones did, and I think that is correct, isn't it?
The Herman's Hermits, and also I think the Dave Clark Five also probably vastly outsold the Rolling Stones in this period. Yeah, we always talk about the Beatles and the Stones as being rivals, but when it comes to who sold the most records, the Beatles were always the clear favorites in that regard.
Another listener writes, for me, the Beatles will always carry a special mystique because of the immense impact they had over such a short period of time. They were only together as a band for 10 years. The Stones have been together and touring since 1962. Their achievement is for endurance and longevity rather than impact, in my opinion. And we are asking you listeners for your opinions. Also, Skip writes, can you discuss the Irish versus English dichotomy, as the Beatles had mostly Irish Catholic working class backgrounds, while the Stones mostly English Welsh Protestant middle-class backgrounds? And can you also discuss the Liverpool versus London dichotomy, which we actually got to, accents, access to markets, audience, influences, social class, etc.? And we will get to that when we come back. We're talking to John McMillan, and this is Sympathy for the Devil by the Rolling Stones.
Please allow me to introduce myself. I'm May, Will, and Jay.
That's the Beatles, Love, Love Me Do. We're talking with Professor John McMillan, who is a historian. teaches at Georgia State University, studies 20th century social movements, and has written a book called Beatles versus Stones about the two great rock and roll bands, which dominated the scene in the 60s and 70s. And, well, the Stones are still around, of course. But they had totally different images, and a lot of them were manufactured, and a lot of them were certainly purveyed by people behind the scenes, the Boy Next Door Beatles, the Born to Be Wild Rolling Stones. In fact, journalist Tom Wolfe wrote that the Beatles want to hold your hand, but the Stones want to burn down your town. And we're asking listeners to kind of weigh in here. And I had a question that I threw to Professor McMillan from a listener named Skip before we went to the break. But let me just read some of your responses here and get them on the record. We actually asked the question on Facebook about preference and asked our listeners to weigh in about which band they preferred. Lily writes, Beatles, hands down. They were much more soulful and universally appealing. Carolyn says, Beatles because they made me happy. Kelly says, I never understood the need for a rivalry. Both groups have been wildly successful. There's no better or worse. And Nelson writes, trick question, it's all about the Kinks. let me read also some emails that came through. Joseph says, there's really no comparison between the Beatles and the Stones. The Beatles win handily in just about every category that matters. The Stones were adept at chasing trends, but the Beatles set those trends and defied expectations at every turn. The Beatles arguably never put out a bad record and broke new ground with each release, but the Stones can make no such claim. And John says, I love the Stones anthem masterpieces. Give me Shelter, Sympathy for the Devil, Paint It Black, but the rest of their catalog I can take or leave. The Beatles, on the other hand, I love, regardless of period or style, from wannabe Chuck Berry pop songs to the psychedelic dreamscapes. And Nick tweets, Stones versus Beatles, but who had more fun? I would say Keith Richards had much more fun than both bands combined. And Rick writes, what a great time. Every Beatle and Stones album was an event, but the Beatles matured so greatly between albums that their albums were just a slight bit more interesting. But the best of the Stones is as great as the best of the Beatles, like Revolver and Let It Bleed. Ralph says, fortunately, we didn't have to choose. They were and are both great, different styles for different occasions. By the way, a fantastic Beatles tribute band is the Fab Four. So, John McMillan, let me go back to Skip's question. Can you talk about Irish versus English dichotomy as far as the Beatles, mostly Irish Catholic working class, and the Stones, mostly English Welsh Protestant, middle class?
That gets a little bit more pedantic than I go into in the book, but sure, Liverpool was a city that teemed with a lot of, you know, descendants of Irish refugees. And in post-World War II England, you know, it was a very class-conscious society. And so the Beatles were, you know, the type of – they were looking at a career of very low-wage, low-prestige expectations if they had not made it as sort of rock and rollers. And the same was not true about the Rolling Stones. And I guess we delved into some of this a bit earlier. But, you know, the Rolling Stones were a bit snobbish. They looked at Liverpool the way someone from maybe – you know, New York City might look at someone from the deep south. You know, they just thought that there was nothing really culturally going on there. And they were a little stupefied, I think, to see the Beatles having such tremendous success.
Could you also, before we go to our callers here, talk a little bit about a release called We Love You, which came out in 1967, because it features uncredited backing vocals by both Lennon and McCartney?
Sure. It's a very interesting song. It was a big hit in England, but it's not as well known here in the United States, where I think it only appeared as a B-side. But the Rolling Stones had some trouble with the law, and they were facing some drug charges, and they got a tremendous outpouring of support from fans, of course, but also from some establishment figures who felt that maybe the Stones had been unfairly targeted. And so they recorded this song, We Love You, which was widely understood as sort of a thank you to their fans, but also it came on the heels of All You Need Is Love, the Beatles song, and once again there were some questions about whether or not the Stones were glomming on to the Beatles' love aesthetic.
We have it. John McMillan with us, author of The Beatles versus Stones. How did Lennon and McCartney get on that record, just aside from sympathy with what the Stones were going through?
Well, they were invited to the studio while the Stones were recording that song, and by every account, the Stones were having a tough time. They couldn't get the song going. You know, it wasn't going well. And John and Paul showed up, and very quickly, you know, they restructured the song around their own high backing vocals and basically repaired a song that the Stones couldn't get going. And so that was a nice favor the Beatles did for the Stones. According to their record company agreements, John and Paul could not be credited as having participated on the song. So everyone kind of knew they did it, but they didn't get official credit.
And who was doing backup for Carly Simon? Do you know? Was it Mick Jagger in You're So Vain?
I hesitate to venture on that, but I don't think so.
All right, let me go to our calls, and we go first to Lucille. Good morning.
Good morning.
Yes, ma'am. You're on the air.
I would like to point out that as a mother of teenagers, they tend to listen a lot to the Beatles, but never to the Stones. And when I once asked them among a group of friends to succinctly tell me what the difference is, they said the Beatles make music and the Stones make noise.
Well, dovetailing on your comments, Lucille, which we thank you for, is an email I'm looking at here from a listener named Robert who says, in terms of how the Beatles and the Rolling Stones relate to young people, I have a friend who works at Mission High School, and it seems that his musically inclined students continue to show interest and curiosity about the Beatles, whereas he's rarely asked about the Rolling Stones. An unscientific poll, perhaps, but there you go. Comment, John McMillan?
I think very young children love the Beatles. That's something I've noticed. And, I became a Beatles fan before I was even 10 years old, having discovered a few records in my parents' collection. And then I loved them then. And then as I got older, I learned to appreciate them at a different and more sophisticated level. So I think there's something to that. There's a fantastic YouTube video, which I encourage your listeners to try to find, where they film young children listening to the Beatles and seeing the Beatles for the first time, more or less. And they film the reactions of these kids. And because it was such a charming little cute thing to see. Young kids really like the Beatles a lot.
And we'll go to more of your calls. We welcome Lisa. Good morning, Lisa.
Hi. I feel like your characterization of the Rolling Stones as kind of bad boys is kind of really underplaying their sexism. And I think the Rolling Stones, their image, their music, and their lives really was about treating women like meat. I'm not saying this is their whole being, but I just saw a recent documentary of the Stones where the women who were following them around, the groupies, were really treated like meat. And their song, Under Your Thumb, Under My Thumb, I mean, I really feel like it's a celebration of male privilege in terms of sex. You know, it's... And you hear it in the comment that the guy, one of your listeners, put in, the Rolling Stones are fun. Fun for whom?
I remember all the controversy about Under Your Thumb, and it was rampant at that time. What about sexism or even misogyny in the Stones versus the Beatles, John McMillan?
Well, I describing the Beatles as bad boys doesn't underplay their sexism. I think it underscores it. That was part of their aesthetic. You know, what's interesting is that, you know, some of the most, I guess, sexist or the put-down songs from the mid-60s didn't create a much of a backlash when they came out. That happened a bit later, I think, when the radical feminist movement got going in the late 60s and early 70s. People looked back at some of the early Stone songs and found very good reasons for critique, and they were certainly overdue for condemnation on the sexism charge. I don't dispute that one bit.
And thank you, Lisa, for the call. And on we go to more of your calls. Jerry joins us. Hi, Jerry.
Yes, hi. I would say, you know, they're both titans. The Stones and the Beatles, both amazing. However, the Beatles have to win hands down. They covered such a range, everything from Eleanor Rigby, which could have been written in the 20s, to Helter Skelter and Revolution 9. I mean, they just broke so many barriers, not to mention the tension between McCartney and Lennon, just having those three strong voices with George Harrison writing. I mean, there was just so much more coming out of them creatively. The Stones were amazing, and they covered their own ground, but they were they were in a much narrower range between, you know, their sound really did not waver as much. And I think it's just the Beatles win hands down on that one.
Well, thank you for the call. Of course, a lot of people pointed that out to you, I'm sure, John McMillan, about the range of the Beatles' music as opposed to the Stones.
Sure.
But yeah, here's no, a listener. No, I'm sorry. Go ahead, please.
Oh, I was just going to say, you know, I don't write a lot about, you know, my own aesthetic preferences in the book, in part because, as you said, I'm a historian and I'm not a musician. I don't really have the vocabulary or the wherewithal necessarily to delve too much into, you know, which band I prefer. But I don't think it's anyone would disagree with the fact that the Beatles were a bit more versatile. And the Stones, by far, were at their best when they were concentrating in their finest medium, which is, you know, blues-inflected rock and roll. But the Stones were, I think, the more creative and versatile and path-breaking group. I think that's fair to say.
Well, here's Gary who writes, I never once had any interest in the Beatles. Yuck, but the Stones. It is impossible to hear a few seconds of any Stones tune and not start moving. Even the little snips you've played make me dance for a few seconds. There's a reason why they have endured so long. And others weighing in here. Therese writes, the Beatles, because the Beatles can make you feel so much. It's bittersweet the way they spoke for how we felt. The people they were seemed to be so much a part of our lives. The Stones, lots of fun. I saw them at Winterland in 1972, and it was a truly great show. Their music never makes me feel the way the Beatles do, and I think their music is much more complex. Some more of your emails here weighing in. Mike says, I love both equally for different reasons. Without getting too deep in music theory, there were big differences between these two hallowed groups, melodically and harmonically. Beatles chord progressions were more varied and the Stones more repeated chord patterns, chord-oriented. Also, for much of the Beatles' recorded career, they had astute and classically trained producer, George Martin. The Stones did not, but created their own wonderful original sound with a completely different guitar tone and phrasing, plus a much more energetic, inventive drummer, repeating a chord pattern used by many other groups for much of music. Well, you said, John McMillan, you're not a musicologist and you are a historian, but any response to that?
not particularly. You know, I don't mean to be impolite by not declaring a preference, but I just didn't want to draw attention from what my main concerns were in the book, which is, again, it's about how the rivalry was constructed by fans and people in the media and by the groups themselves. And, you know, you can go to a lot of online fora where there are some incredibly acrimonious disputes between partisans for one group over the or the other. And so as much as possible, I try to hide my preference. Although I do, in fact, have – there is I do prefer one group over the other. I just haven't
– I think you stated in – I believe I read that you prefer the Beatles.
Oh, well, where did you – okay, so you did some research, but I – in the book, I don't –
You're not taking both sides, are you?
I was hoping to keep that between me and you, but you've already said that I prefer the Beatles.
Well, yes, here's a listener who writes, Rolling Stone magazine once astutely pointed out that the Beatles paved the way and enabled the Stones to take the position of rule breakers. In other words, without a center, there could not be a left. And another listener writes, I'll take Led Zeppelin, musically speaking. Beatles and Stones were more important culturally, but my preference is probably because I came of age in the 70s. And let's hear from some more of our listeners. We'll go to Christina next. Christina, thanks for waiting. Join us.
Oh, thank you. No, this is an interesting discussion, although I don't like saying one wins or the other one doesn't. But getting to understand a perspective of what they meant and what they mean to music now, I think, is fun.
And culture.
But, yeah. Anyway, there's a group of Phoenix from, I think they're from Versailles, and they play like an American or an English group, really very talented young group, and they were asked about their influences. You know, they mentioned the Rolling Stones and Led Zeppelin, but they said the Beatles taught us they taught the world how to play rock and roll. And really, you think about what a catalyst the Beatles were for, you know, really making rock and roll more universal rather than just making it, you know, it's still kind of English specific. But they said that they were like the alphabet for rock and roll. And I always thought that was a very interesting comment coming from young musicians.
Well, thank you for that, and appreciate your call. John McMillan again with us, assistant professor of history at Georgia State and author of Beatles versus Stones. And we go to more of your phone calls. And next up, Johan, welcome.
Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you for this discussion. Please feel free to redirect this question, as I do not want to take us off the path of this lovely discussion. But I wonder, you know, I really wonder, and going back to your comment about time is on our side, Michael, if the Stones had not lasted as long, first point, or I should say secondly, if Jim Morrison of the Doors hadn't died so early in his career, I wonder if this dichotomy might actually be the Beatles versus the Doors. But it's really interesting to hear what you have to say about that, Professor.
John McMillan?
I think the fact that the Rolling Stones kept going may have, you know, ironically diminished their legacy to some degree among rock fans, because, you know, the Stones had a great run from, let's say, 68 to 72, where they put out, you know, some of the best and most enduring rock records in history. Also, Some Girls in 1978 was a great record. But then they tended to dilute their catalog, I would argue. And this is not just my opinion. A lot of critics have noticed an obvious decline in the quality of the Stones' work, you know, since the 70s. And the Beatles never did that. They broke up when they were still very much near the height of their power, and they never shared a stage again or anything else. And so in that sense, the Beatles may have preserved, you know, a certain mystique that the Stones don't have. People often are amazed by the longevity of the Stones and the fact that they've carried on for 43 years longer than the Beatles. And some people find that very impressive, but they're not really pushing new material. They're to a large degree, kind of a nostalgia act. They're playing their same old hits from many years ago. And when they perform those songs live, they play them exactly as they sounded on the records and they were recorded ages ago. And so by not really pushing new material and evolving, I think the Stones may have diminished their legacy to some degree.
Well, I saw them when they performed here in San Francisco, and Keith Richards came out, and one of the first things he said was, "Yes, I'm still alive." I mean, I'm probably using that line almost at all the concerts they're doing or all the performances they're doing, but especially with his, shall we say, record in terms of drug use, not to mention his longevity. It is maybe amazing that he's still alive. I was going to ask you, though, I want to get local for a moment with you, because there's a story about SDS in Berkeley and the singing of Yellow Submarine. Can you tell that?
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's just a minor incident in the book, but thanks for bringing it up. Sure. A lot of young protesters in Berkeley, and I guess 1966, where they were trying to sing some of the old labor songs that were popular, you know, Solidarity Forever and Ever Else, trying to build a kind of collective consciousness around their movement. But no one could remember the words to those old labor standbys. But someone started singing Yellow Submarine, and then, of course, everyone joined in. And so the Beatles were a soundtrack for a lot of youth culture activists in Berkeley and in the Bay Area in that period.
Now, if memory serves me, I think Yellow Submarine was the only song that was written by Ringo. Is that correct? Yeah.
Well, I think now so. You may be upstaging me. Ringo certainly sang that song. I don't know if he wrote it, but
I think he wrote it.
He got the songwriting credit? Okay. Then that's something I wasn't aware of.
Well, and Harrison got credit for My Sweet Lord, which he did, and he got sued for. There was a plagiarism suit that was won by... He's So Fine, the Chiffons songwriter, which is kind of strange because they never sounded even similar to me. But here's Tom from San Francisco who writes, in the Playboy interview, John Lennon said he and Paul McCartney met Mick Jagger and Richards in a club in 1963 because they promised to write I Want to Be Your Man for the Stones. They played a few licks for Jagger and Richards. They said they liked the song, and then John and Paul went off to a corner and wrote the rest of the song in about 10 minutes. That blew Jagger's mind. He supposedly responded, if they can write that way, maybe we should try writing songs. Now, there have been different versions of that story, John McMillan. You want to be the historian here?
That's pretty close to what happened. That's the Beatles. You know, the Stones were known for doing covers of you know, blues numbers, and they had a minor hit, but they were looking for another song to record, and nothing was really working out. But the Beatles were changing the rules of the game to the extent that John and Paul were writing songs, you know, that were very popular, and they were donating songs to other artists. They had more songs than they knew what to do with, and so yes, they finished "I Want to Be Your Man" at a rehearsal space that the Stones were using, and they did it right in front of their eyes, and the Stones were a bit flabbergasted with the apparent ease with which John and Paul did that song, and it became a hit for the Stones. It went to number 12 on the UK chart.
Well, let's hear cuts from both versions. First, the Stones.
I wanna be your lover, baby. Thank you.
Well, let me correct something. I did not upstage you, John McMillan. Yellow Submarine, and thanks to Dan Zold for this, who goes on the hunt very quickly, which came out in 1966, was written by Paul McCartney. It was credited to Lennon and McCartney, but the lead vocals, of course, were Ringo Starr's. But here's Michael on Facebook who writes, I love the Stones and was a Stones over Beatles fan in the day because I was a rebel and looked to the Stones for revolution. The best album of the two was the Stones' Between the Buttons for its psychedelic flair, but the Beatles became tantamount to the leaders of a generation. We had a family that hung out at a central house when Sgt. Pepper came out. We got it on the first day of release and sat around the house listening and looking for guidance as to what we should do next in the peace and love movement. And here's Dave who writes, during Beatlemania, I was a grade school, middle school student. I liked the Beatles much more than the Rolling Stones at the time, likely due to my then being an evangelical Christian. The Beatles were more clean cut, though I can still hear my mom's voice as we watched them on TV in 1964. Look at their hair. Well, let's get another caller on, and that's you, Chuck. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to comment, growing up in the 60s, people forget that the real early competition for the Beatles was with the Beach Boys, and there was a big battle going on early on until maybe Rubber Soul and some of the other stuff.
Yeah, you want to talk about that, John McMillan? Is it in your purview?
Sure. Well, I somewhat disagree. I mean, the fact is, sure, the Beach Boys record Pet Sounds was such a tremendous record, and Paul McCartney talked about it as one of his favorite records. And I think there was a lot of competition going on, not just the Beatles and the Stones. The Kinks, who someone mentioned before, and to some degree the Who and other groups were all in the same mix. And people were aware of what each other was doing. But the Beatles and the Stones shared a lot in common. They both came from England at roughly the same time. They both were influenced by African-American artists, although there were some differences. The Beatles were a little more Motown, the Stones more blues, of course. I mentioned the class differences and whatnot. They had so much in common, and yet there were certain differences between the Beatles and the Stones that really make comparison irresistible, and I think put the Beatles-Stones debate in a slightly different category than the Beatles and the Beach Boys. But the caller's correct. They were all this stuff was going on at the same time, and everyone was very much aware of what the others were doing, and everyone was trying to outperform each other.
Where do you weigh in as far as the whole controversy about Yoko Ono and her role or her contribution of breaking up the Beatles? I mean, she took a lot of flack and a lot of culpability that probably may have been ill-deserved. How do you see it?
Great question. You know, it's a logical fallacy to suggest that, you know, any one thing as complicated as the Beatles breakup could be attributed to one cause, rather. So I think it would be short-sighted and wrong to say that Yoko Ono was the cause of the Beatles' breakup. But having said that, she and John really subsumed themselves into each other, and I don't think that she was terribly considerate towards the other Beatles or their helpmates or their friends. I think she had a difficult personality. I think John was kind of in a desperate situation where he relied very heavily on Yoko. And instead of maybe looking for the collective good or the greater good and trying to keep the Beatles going, I think Yoko was not unhappy to see him fracturing, and I think she may have played a role in all that. So there are many other issues as well.
Again, John McMillan with us, author of Beatles versus Stones. And I want to get to more calls here, but when you talk about, say, the Fab Four, and some call the Rolling Stones the Thug Five, which a lot of that is, of course, marketing and agents and all the like, but there was a sense of group versus individuals, wasn't there?
Sure. One of the neat things about the Beatles is that they were actually one of the first groups to come out of England that styled themselves as a collective group, as a kind of communal gang of very good friends. And everybody knows that they had slightly different personalities within the group, but they had a lovely collective chemistry. Someone, George Martin, their producer, once said the Beatles had this wonderful quality that makes you feel, you know, enjoyment in their company and diminished when they leave. And the Rolling Stones were never very friendly or trusting towards each other. There was a lot of petty squabbling and power struggles within the group, and so they did not style themselves in that way. And the Beatles all wore matching suits and uniforms, which in some ways symbolized, I think, their, you know, collective identity. And the Stones didn't bother with the stage uniforms. They dressed the way they wanted, and I think that showed maybe the disparate personalities within the groups in some fashion.
And here's Bill from Cupertino. Bill, welcome. You're on the air.
Yeah, I saw the Rolling Stones in 1963 back east in Massachusetts, Worcester, and you know, I always thought they were both excellent groups, but the Rolling Stones had more pimples. And when we're on that subject, because I had pimples at the same time, and they were kind of the bad boys, like somebody made in an earlier comment. And no one's, I haven't heard you guys talk about Eric Burdon, because he was really, when you saw Eric Burdon and you were 15 or 14 or 13, he was, and the Kingsmen, you know, those were the people that were.
You're talking about the whole British invasion here. We that's maybe a program for another day. Yeah, the Animals and the Dave Clark Five. I mean, you know, they were certainly antecedent to the Beatles and the Rolling Stones, and part of that what was then called the British Invasion. I just want to read a few more emails. John writes, I think the Rolling Stones were initially received poorly in the U.S. because their musical roots were based on American blues. The Stones' first two albums were very bluesy. American pop music fans were slow to appreciate the Stones singing Little Red Rooster. The Beatles, on the other hand, came from a folk rock idiom, and all kinds of people weighing in. Sorry, we don't have time for them. Thank you, John McMillan. The book again, Beatles versus Stones.
Oh, thank you very much. I really enjoyed the conversation, and thanks for having me.
Let's spend the night together. Rolling Stones.
I'm going red, my tongue's getting tired. Tongue's getting tired. I'm up ahead, my mouth's getting dry.
Better chop, 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 hold back.
Let's spend the night together. Now I need you more than ever. Let's spend the night together.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.